You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment, with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. With four daughters and two on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house. But I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you got to get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara. You're going to love it.
The amazing Kate Casey.
Welcome back to another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. Hope that you've had a great week, and I hope that you've purchased tickets from one of my two live shows. I've got a show on November 20th at the City Winery in New York City, and then December 3rd at the Hollywood Improv in Los Angeles. So make sure that you get those tickets. This episode is all about Lori Vallow, known as the Doomsday Mom. She's been called a monster and a cult mom, and she's accused of murdering her children, Tylee Ryan and JJ Vallow, who vanished. She is also the subject of a Netflix 3-part docuseries airing next week called Sins of Our Mother. Tylee Ryan was 16 and Joshua Jackson, JJ Vallow, was 7 when they disappeared in September of 2019 and were found dead in June of 2020 in Rexburg, Idaho. Tylee was last seen alive at Yellowstone National Park on September 8th of 2019, and her younger brother, JJ, was last seen alive on September 23rd, 2019, at Rexburg's Kennedy Elementary School. On September 24th, he was initially reported missing by relatives, concerned not only that the children, from whom they had not heard from in weeks, but also several other suspicious incidents. In November of 2019, police questioned the children's mother, Lori, about the children's whereabouts and welfare. Lori and her new husband, Chad Daybell, were evasive about their whereabouts. Chad met Lori at a prepper conference in 2018. With his apocalyptic prophecies and visions, the author and excommunicated Mormon drew thousands of followers, most of them women, into his thrall. Unknown to his wife, Tammy, the couple started an affair. Lori and Chad claimed that JJ was staying with a family friend, Melanie Gibb, in Arizona, where they had lived before moving to Idaho in early September 2019. When police reached Melanie Gibb by phone, she told police that Joshua, JJ, was not with her and had not been there for several months. And more than a week later, Melanie Gibb called police saying that both Lori and Chad had asked her to lie to police about JJ's whereabouts, but she had refused. Police efforts to locate JJ also led to the discovery that Tylee was also missing. Complicating circumstances around the disappearances was a string of suspicious deaths. Lori's estranged husband, Charles Vallow, was shot and killed in July of 2019 by her brother, Alex Cox, who claimed self-defense. In 2019, Charles Vallow became very worried about Lori, and he went to the police with his concerns. He told them Lori believed she was a god preparing for the end of days, and he also said that Lori had threatened to murder him. Alex Cox died of a blood clot on December 12, 2019. In early October of 2019, Brandon Boudreau, the then estranged husband of Lori's niece Melanie, was shot in the driveway of his Gilbert, Arizona home from a vehicle still registered to the deceased, Charles Vallow. In October of 2019, Chad's wife Tammy Daybell was attacked in her driveway by what she believed was someone shooting a defective paintball gun. A few weeks later, on October 19th, she died in her sleep from what was initially reported as natural causes. No postmortem or autopsy was initially performed. Chad and Lori married 2 weeks later in Hawaii, and there were no guests. So law enforcement became suspicious and exhumed Tammy's corpse for autopsy. A joint task force of law enforcement across states in which Lori and Chad had lived began looking for Tylee and JJ in November, as Lori's initial claims that Tylee was at university and JJ was staying with friends fell apart. January 25th, 2020, authorities served Lori Vallow Daybell an order requiring her to produce her children. February 20th, 2020, after failing to comply, Lori was arrested in Hawaii, and 2 weeks later, she was extradited to Idaho. And even after Lori's arrest, the couple refused to say where the children were. Now, it's also important to note, on September 9th of 2019, the morning after Tylee Ryan disappeared, investigators say that Alex Cox's cell phone GPS placed him in Chad Daybell's backyard on the property for about 2 hours. About 14 minutes after Alex Cox's GPS showed him leaving the property, Chad Daybell texted his wife, Tammy, and the text read, "I spotted a big raccoon along the fence. I hurried and got my gun, and he was still walking along. I got close enough that one shot did the trick. He is now in our pet cemetery." On September 23rd, 2019, the day after JJ was last seen, investigators say Alex Cox's cell phone showed that Alex Cox returned to Chad Daybell's backyard, and this time he was there for only 17 minutes. On June 9th, 2020, the FBI, Rexburg Police, and Fremont County Sheriff's Office descended upon Chad Daybell's home and property. They dug in areas of the backyard where Alex Cox's cell phone had pinged in September of 2019. Tragically, they uncovered human remains buried in shallow graves. JJ had been buried under a tree, and about 50 yards away, investigators found Tylee's grave in the Daybell's pet cemetery. Prosecutors believe she was buried in the same location Chad referenced when he texted Tammy 9 months earlier saying he was burying a raccoon. Chad Daybell was arrested. He'd been a grave digger for many years, and it appeared to investigators that he had helped dispose of his mistress's children's bodies. Between July and December of 2019, three people had died and two children had disappeared, and the one thing that they all had in common was their closeness to Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell. Alex Cox's death made the case against Daybell and Vallow more complicated, as cops believed that he may have been the person who actually killed Tylee and JJ. On February 20th of 2020, Lori was arrested in Hawaii and charged with desertion and non-support of her dependent children. She was extradited to Idaho and transported there by officials on March 5th of 2020. On June 9th, 2020, police executed a search warrant at Chad's home and discovered the remains of JJ and Tylee. Chad was arrested later that day on charges of destruction and concealment of evidence. And on May 25th, 2021, Lori and Chad were both charged with first-degree murders of Tylee, JJ, and Tammy. Investigators believe Lori had hoped to benefit from ex-husband Charles' life insurance, but what she and Chad did not know was that Charles, who had started and then stopped divorce proceedings, feared her. He had changed the policy to name his sister Kay as the sole beneficiary, even telling family that if anything happened to him, that Lori and Chad would be behind it. By then, Lori had bought into Chad's bizarre belief system and told Charles that she believed that he had been a zombie possessed with a dark spirit. Chad Daybell claimed he could see light and dark spirits and that he had lived many times over, and he said that he and Lori had been married in previous lives. They both were convinced that certain people, her husband Charles and later Tylee and JJ among them, were zombies who had been possessed by dark spirits and could only be released through death. Killing these zombies, Chad preached, was acceptable. They believed they were translated beings who did not require food or sleep, had accelerated healing powers, and could not be mortally wounded and could teleport. Currently, Chad Daybell is sitting in prison awaiting trial, scheduled for January of 2023, and he has pled not guilty. Prosecutors have sought the death penalty. They have cited the fact that all of these alleged crimes were committed for remuneration, life insurance, and Social Security payments as aggravating circumstances. Authorities have described the murders of Ty Lee and JJ especially heinous, atrocious, or cruel, manifesting depravity. Lori Vallow is also awaiting trial. She's been declared mentally incompetent. She is currently being treated in a secure mental health facility in Idaho. In this episode, I interview Skye Borgman, director of Sins of Our Mother, the three-part Netflix series examining the Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell murder case. Sins of Our Mother explores how Lori Daybell spiraled downward into religious fanaticism and paranoia to find herself and her fifth husband standing trial for murder. The story is told through the eyes of Colby Ryan, Lori's oldest son. I also interview Dr. John Mathias, licensed clinical and forensic psychologist with over 25 years experience in both clinical and forensic work. He serves as an expert witness for the federal government, and he has consulted on numerous high-profile cases for district attorneys' offices and defense attorneys in several states. He is featured in Sins of Our Mother. Here are my interviews with Skye and Dr. John Mathias. Listen, I don't know where you are in your comfortable clothes journey, but I am going to change your life. You need to be wearing Vuori. You're going to do a lot of things this fall: hiking, running, lounging, and watching my must-watch list. And you need to feel nothing but joy and comfort. The minute I was gifted with a black pair of Vuori performance joggers, my life, it was forever changed. Never had I enjoyed such comfort while working out or on the go. Listen, I love Vuori so much, I'm now converting all of my friends and family too. My husband cannot imagine sleeping again without a Vuori men's ponto short. My sister is now fully embracing the daily legging and the energy top. Her boxing trainer now wears Vuori shorts. Her hairdresser, Vanessa, is now wearing Vuori performance joggers. We all love Vuori, and let me tell you something, you will too. So go now to Vuori.com/Kate. That's Vuori.com/Kate to get 20% off your first order. That's Vuori.com/Kate to get 20% off your first order. This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. If you're looking for new style inspiration, Saks.com is the place to go. Saks.com is making it easy for me to shop for the spring with their selection of chic clothes and accessories. Right now, I'm looking at Saks.com so I can find my new going out vibe. I'm looking for a breezy Zimmermann dress for an evening cocktail party. And for my upcoming conference in Los Angeles, I'm looking at bright Chloe blazers because I'm pushing myself to wear more orange and pink. Saks.com will inspire you to shop for everything on your agenda. So find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com. Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way that you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, and they pass the savings on to us. So I just got a 100% organic cotton tiered maxi skirt in red and a chiffon pleated midi skirt in soft pink. Now I'm going to wear both of them with either a white scoop t-shirt or a black tank top. In fact, wait, should we all get the same outfit and meet for drinks? Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/KateCasey for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/KateCasey to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/KateCasey. Back with me is Skye Borgman, the director. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's always good to be on the show with you.
I know that you've been working on this for 2 years. This is an unusual case for you because, number one, this story is known worldwide. There's a lot of information that we still don't know in this case, and there are new twists and turns, I feel like, every other day. So tell me how you were asked to be part of this project and what the last 2 years have looked like for you in relation to just this project.
Yeah, it is a slightly different project. This one is so high profile, although I think it's high profile. And then I'll talk to somebody and they're like, huh, I've never heard of Lori Vallow.
Wow.
I always judge high profileness based on my mom. Like if my mom's heard about it, then it's high profile. If she hasn't heard about it, then it's not quite so high profile. And she had definitely heard about it. Look, it's been it's been a roller coaster ride working on this. There's just so many emotions involved from every different direction. And it's from the beginning, I mean, you know, I was working on it before Tylee and JJ's remains were found in Chad Daboll's backyard.
Oh, wow.
And so the first time I really, you know, met Colby was at Chad Daboll's fence line.
What?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God.
It was such an emotional, really just jaw-dropping sort of series of events that happened at that time. Because we were talking, look, I was talking with Netflix and I was talking with Lightbox about this story. And I had heard about it, you know, on the news. I had heard about people talking about it. And so I was following it, you know, like everybody else kind of was, and was just like, man, and kept going, you know, it was like, where are the kids? Where are the kids? Where are the kids? And I just kept thinking, man, where are the kids? And everybody thought that they were in a bunker somewhere or hidden out at a camp.
Yeah.
Who thinks that? Like, how is that the first thought that somebody says they're in a bunker somewhere? I mean, and that to me, just the places that people were going where they thought the kids may have been was always curious to me. And so when I got the chance to sort of work on this and dive a little deeper, it's been quite the journey for sure.
Well, take me back to that moment. You're at the fence with Colby. Do you see Chad Daboll's kids? I mean, who is floating around in that orbit?
Nobody was really floating around. I mean, the memorial to the kids was up on the fence line. Mm. But there was not really that many people around. I think that some people may have been going back and forth from his house, but it was just the memorial to the kids. And then there were a few neighbors around who sort of came up to Colby and said, you know, gave them their condolences. But that's about it. It was devastating. I mean, it was really, really devastating.
Now, when you get the news that their bodies have been found, do you as a filmmaker and even your team just sit there and quietly cry for a moment? Because how do you not feel like you've been fully immersed into the lives of all of these people that are directly connected to these children?
I think you are fully immersed in their lives. I mean, look, we have the unique ability to be in their lives and not be in their lives, right? And that's a really interesting dichotomy that ends up happening, because like you get so with them in everything they do, and you're with them at events like with Colby, the fence line, and you're with them with every news thing that happens, and you're talking with them and you're right there with them. But we're never going to be them, right? I'm never going to feel like my brother and my sister are dead. Like, I'll never have that weight of grief and that weight of loss on me. I can be with them to the extent that I can be with them, but I'm never going to be those actual people living through this. And that's something that I think very few people on this planet can really understand, sort of the weight that it takes on survivors, on, you know, family members, on all of these people who are in this hemisphere of the people it's happening to.
Did you feel in that moment with him at the fence, this realization that maybe even his uncle had participated in it?
It's interesting. I don't know if probably at that point, I mean, I'm kind of going back and trying to put the pieces together on how I thought things happened. His uncle's death was, I mean, to say the least, incredibly convenient. And I remember feeling that way at the time. And I didn't quite know what to think of it. And I'm also one of those people. I mean, I think it comes as just part of the documentary process that, you know, I want to do the research. I want to find whatever police reports. I want to do the digging and find out what there is to find out before I make any sort of judgments on things. And so I feel like I probably at that moment was feeling that there could have been, that Alex could have had something to do with it, that he probably had something to do with it. But look, even now, we still don't really know. We really don't know.
So this was interesting. It was nearly finished and ready for release last year, but then police in Arizona released a large file of text messages, photos, video interviews, and other details made public for the first time. So you had to meet with Netflix, and this decision was made to rework the series. While I know that that must have felt overwhelming. I do feel like that the use of the text messages had a completely shocking element. So for you, what was it like to see their communication in text messages? Did it feel as unsettling as I know I felt as someone watching the series?
Yeah, it was a big development when those reports were released, and there were thousands of pages. I mean, there were thousands of pages of stuff that we were going through, and so, you know, putting those together, it was really, in a way, a lot of our thoughts and our feelings were confirmed by seeing those text messages and the communications that were happening sort of back and forth. And so it felt good to be able to go, okay, we've got, I don't know if you want to say we've got proof that this happened, but we've got some really solid communications happening between these people that lead you to believe these certain things happened. And so it was a really interesting moment because it was great that we had, I don't know about great, it was helpful that we had this new information to be able to paint a more detailed, more in-depth picture of what was happening at the time. But we were also close to being finished with the project. So it was a decision that Lightbox had to make, that Netflix had to make, that I had to make, that we were going to go back in and sort of upend what we'd put together and add all of the stuff back in. And it was a tough decision, but it was absolutely worth it in the end.
In early interviews, Janice Cox and her daughter are insisting that Lori could never be capable of murder. Once those text messages were revealed, did you see any shift within the family?
I think that Janice and Summer still hold out hope that, I don't know if it's that Lori is innocent, but I think that they still hold out hope that she isn't as involved as the rest of the world presumes that Lori is. I don't know if it's a mother's nature and a sister's nature to feel that way. Maybe it is, maybe it's their nature to feel that way. I think that they've got a lot of denial happening. And I think that they want something bad enough that they can almost convince themselves of something. But I know they were devastated when she was arrested. I know they were devastated when Tylee and JJ's remains were found. But I think they still have some room in their hearts and in their lives for Lori.
Which is interesting too, because conversely, I feel like Chad's family probably has a similar outlook, where perhaps they're collectively thinking maybe Lori was the person who had put these plans into practice and he is being pulled into something without warrant. So you have two people with two different families who are in a state of denial.
Yeah, I think that both the Daybell family and the Vallow family want to believe that it's the other person, that it was Chad that pulled Lori into this, and that it was Lori that pulled Chad into this. I think it's self-preservation, you know, where that sort of feeling comes from.
You also get the sense that they're very, it's like wavering between secretive and private. I found out later that there was another sibling that passed away that they don't really seem to talk about much, a sister, Stacy, that died in 1998. Is that just the culture that the family grows up in, that like things are kept private, or was there some strange thing associated with the death of their sister?
I mean, there's never been any proof that there was anything strange associated with her death, beyond possibly that they didn't necessarily feel like there could be, they didn't want to take all of the medical extremes that maybe other people may want to take. I don't think that there was much strange with that. Like, I don't think she was murdered, you know, or anything like that. But I do think that it's part of their culture. I think it's part of their religion, that they want to be a strong family, and that's a very important presence to put forward, this family strength and this family unity. And so anything that's perceived to kind of put a chink in that family armor, I feel like they would feel that that's detrimental to being public about.
Now, is there a certain point in Lori's life that you feel like sparked this decline? I wondered myself if it was maybe being a trauma survivor herself, that once she found out that her husband had abused one of her children, Colby comes forward and says that he was a victim of abuse. Was that the moment that the decline began, or do you feel like it preceded that?
I feel like it was a slow, gradual decline for Lori. I think there were a lot of things that were present in her life early on. I do feel like this need for attention, this need for the spotlight was something that from a very early age she had, and that she was always trying to find that spotlight and to be in the spotlight. And that sort of led to kind of this one-upping or something, like trying, you know, this certain level of fame, if you mm-hmm. want to call it that, this being a cheerleader, then she needed to one-up that, or this, she was married to a great man, but he wasn't as spiritually involved. So she needed to kind of do better or go further. And so I think that was always there. And as she went through her life, I think there were certainly very significant moments that she lived through that sort of pushed her further. I think Colby's sexual abuse, I think that whole situation, you know, that whole divorce that was happening with Joe Ryan and splitting of these families and children. And that was a very sort of violent, very, very heated divorce. I think that was part of it. I think the sexual abuse from Colby was part of it. And look, there are people who believe that Colby wasn't sexually abused too. There are many people who think that he was coached to talk about that. I remember talking to John Mathias about Colby's sexual abuse, and he felt that Colby was actually sexually abused, where there are a lot of people who feel that he wasn't. There were a lot of reports and CPS reports that went back and forth, and nothing was ever really conclusive. But he felt that the way that Colby responded when they talked about his sexual abuse was in line with how sexual abuse survivors talk about it. I think that was big for Lori. I think her multiple relationships was a big deal for Lori. I think Colby marrying Kelsey was a very big deal to Lori, and him leaving the LDS church and going with Kelsey and stepping into her faith. I think that was a very big deal to her. And being left without Colby, who I think she placed a lot of her motherhood in Colby, and to have him out of the house, I think she had to really think about ways to redefine herself. And I think that was a big turn for her.
Was she also reliant on him to help her with the children, and that when he left the home, that required her to have much more ownership of her children than maybe she had wanted?
Possibly. I mean, I don't know that he was necessarily taking care of them like a mother would necessarily care for younger kids. But I think he was such a parent to them in so many ways. You know, he was very present in their lives. He loved them like crazy. I mean, I know when JJ came into their lives, like, it totally changed everything. Like, Colby just loved mm-hmm. him. And so I do think that he was sort of going off, and I think more what it was him going away from Lori and finding a light in another woman, and Lori really feeling the loss of that.
Also, in her family of origin, there seems to be this a fixation on Lori. Like, Lori is so beautiful. Lori is this. And there's certainly a strange dynamic with Lori and Alex. Could you put your finger on that? Like, what was the dynamic between Lori and her brother?
I think there was a lot that they were, their relationship was very much that Lori was kind of in charge of that relationship, and Alex felt like he wanted to do whatever he could for Lori, that he was her protector in a sense. And she would ask him to protect her against certain things. I mean, certainly when he went and tased Joe Ryan, she had asked for that protection, and that he was somebody who would do whatever she asked him to do. And I think that she got very accustomed to him in that role. And I think that role, I don't know if it like grew or if it became closer together, but whatever that was how they were together, was that she would ask him to do things and he would, without much hesitation, do them.
I just kept thinking about these two sweet children who had such chaos in their short lives and what they must have seen in the months before their deaths and how she was spiraling. How many people in her life also saw those signs and do you think didn't raise their hand, never spoke up until after all of this happened, or maybe not even now?
I think there's a lot. I mean, I think, you know, when I see it the most is when I'm watching some of the body cam footage where Tylee's in the room with Lori, and the way that Tylee's presence around Lori, like she's almost taking control when Lori's starting to lose control a little bit. And you can see Tylee sort of being almost a mother figure to Lori in a lot of ways, or kind of giving her cues about how she should respond to things. I think there were a lot of people who saw red flags, or where red flags were present and people may not have been paying attention. And I think a big part of that is Lori herself, and that she is an attractive blonde woman. And I think that people sort of were able to look past, or not even register, that a woman, a beautiful blonde woman, could be a perpetrator. And that's something I think we really need to sort of look at ourselves about too, is making these judgments. Look, we do it all the time. We look at somebody and we say, that guy looks like this, or that guy looks like that. But to really kind of look at the signs and not so much look at the people involved, because we're going to steer ourselves wrong. And I do think there were opportunities, many, many opportunities, to stop this, or to at least divert this terrible tragedy from happening, if we listened to a couple of those signs that were absolutely there at the beginning.
Do you think that there was one person in her whole life that actually knew or knows who she really is, Lori Vallow?
Lori Vallow.
Right.
I think she's the only one. I think she puts a different face forward to everyone. And I think she's the only one that really knows.
My last question is whether there was anything that you wish you could have included but couldn't, for the sake of time or continuity, like the something that you just wish, oh, if I could have included that.
I think we were able to get everything in that we wanted to. I mean, I know when we first started down the road of discovering this story and figuring out what this story was about, and kind of looking at it from the perspective that we look at it, I thought that it would go to trial within the time span that we were working in. So I was hoping, I don't know if I was hoping, but I thought that we might have a conclusion to that. But the trial kept getting pushed, and there were so many different things that sort of came into play that we kind of felt like we wanted to tell this story, and that the trial became a little bit less important to, like, knowing exactly what the outcome is. The world will know what the outcome is when the trial happens. So I feel like at one point I may have wished the trial happened, but then we got to a point where it just felt a little less necessary, that our hope was that we could get the spirit of Tylee and JJ across to everybody, and that we could put these events into some sort of order, that we could get some kind of understanding about Lori Vallow, and to an extent to get some kind of understanding about her family around her, about Colby, around Janice, and her friends too. So to just have a little bit more understanding of how something like this can happen.
Do you think that she's elated about this series? Because it does seem like she just loves attention, even when it's negative.
I think she might be.
Yeah.
I hope that Tylee and JJ are honored through this film. It was absolutely my intention to sort of lift them up and show what incredible young children they were. And to look at the struggles of Lori's family, to look at the struggles of Colby, to look at the struggles of everybody sort of associated with her, and to remember that these are real people and they're dealing with real things.
Well done. Great job.
Thanks so much.
Whether you need to buy or sell, or you're just obsessed with looking at homes for sale, Redfin's got you covered. Redfin updates their listings every 2 minutes so you can see new homes first. And they give you personalized recommendations based on the homes that you like, so you can find the home that's just right for you, whether that's a cabin, a craftsman, or a castle. With the top-rated Redfin app, you can favorite homes, share listings with others, and schedule tours, and even on the same day, with a local Redfin agent who can help guide you through the whole home buying process. And if you're looking to sell, Redfin agents have the experience to get you the best price possible for your home. That's because they sell twice as many homes as other agents. With a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin's fees are half of what others often charge, which means you'll have more money to put towards what matters most to you, like your next home. In fact, last year, Redfin saved home sellers $127 million. No matter where you are in your real estate journey, Redfin can help. Download the Redfin app to get started today.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Dr. John Mathias is a licensed clinical and forensic psychologist with over 25 years' experience in both clinical and forensic work. He's performed over 500 forensic and psychological evaluations and risk assessments for the courts since 1996, assessing the risk for violent and sexual recidivism for both adults and juveniles. He serves as an expert witness for the federal government. He's consulted on numerous high-profile cases for district attorney's offices and defense attorneys in several states, and he's featured in Sins of Our Mother. Welcome, John.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate being here.
I really loved every moment that you were in this docuseries, and I think that your insight is most helpful. So I wanted to ask you a couple questions. You're featured in this docuseries and have explored the psychology of Lori Vallow, her family, and Chad Daybell in your podcast, Hidden True Crime, with your wife, Lauren, who's a journalist. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about the research you've done and your observations as a forensic psychologist. And first, I wanted to start with the environment that Lori Vallow grew up in. Mm-hmm. What was the environment that she grew up in?
There's some research talking about narcissistic families, which I think is probably the case here. To call a family narcissistic, by the way, wouldn't be a diagnostic label. It would just be describing the family culture, which would be essentially a family culture led by a narcissist, which in this case would be Barry Cox, the father. And typically what you see in those types of families is what you might expect, which is that most of the attention is absorbed by the narcissist or the father in this case. And so there's very little sunlight that's shed on the children or anyone else in the family and very little attention that gets paid to them. So a lot of the culture is focused on the narcissistic person and there's some level of neglect going on in the rest of the family. And a lot of times that can result in a lot of dysfunctions like siblings competing with each other for attention or siblings acting out, or, you know, there's so many ways that gets expressed. But essentially, I sort of see this family as being a narcissistic family, but then with an overlay of a lot of paranoia. There's a lot of extreme beliefs here. This is not just a typical Mormon family, but sort of an extreme Mormon family that's out on the fringes. And Barry Cox, for example, has had this long-running feud with the IRS about, you know, the government and the deep state creating problems and all that kind of stuff. And there's a lot of paranoia. And I think when you combine those two elements into a family culture, you know, it's a setup for a lot of mental health problems with the children.
And Barry is basically setting the tone for them to grow up to be adults that are also yes. paranoid and obsessive.
Right.
Now, she said in testimony that Satan had been abusing her for years. Mm-hmm. What kind of abuse do you presume that included?
Yeah, I've speculated on that. And right, that's a tricky one. You know, there's some evidence that there's been physical and or maybe even sexual abuse in the family. It's not clear who did what to whom, but clearly this is a family. You know, the research shows that in families like this, it's more likely you're going to get some type of abuse. You know, in one of the text messages in the now infamous love story text is what we call them from Chad Daybell to Lori. There's some moments in there where he talks about healing all of her past wounds, right? And that sort of implies abuse, but they're not, you know, it's not specific. So it's hard to really extrapolate the exact type of abuse. But I think at a minimum, I think it's fair to say that this was a traumatic environment. Even if this is some type of neglect, right? This is not a normal, healthy family culture. And I think one way or another, that gets expressed in Lori's behaviors down the road.
Now, as a young girl, her father says in the docuseries that she was always taken by scripture. Mm-hmm. Was her faith always the center of her life?
It seems that way. I think that, and again, going back to the family culture, you know, that's not just Lori, right? That's part of that culture. That's part of the parental belief system. The parents are taken by scripture. They're taken by extremism. And so it wouldn't be unexpected that Lori would adopt some of those beliefs. I mean, I think it would be an inaccurate characterization to say that the parents had nothing to do with her interest in scripture, because they had a lot to do with it. So, and the family culture had a lot to do with it. So I don't know if that's kind of him transferring blame to her and saying that she was unusual, but certainly, yes, she's someone who probably had a lot of interest in scripture from an early age. And then later, she became obsessed with things like the Twilight series. I had a chance to meet with Colby for quite a bit of time, and Colby, you know, disclosed that his mother was just absolutely riveted by Twilight, and she almost acted as if Twilight was a reality in her life.
Right.
And so I think with Lori, you have this constant conflict between fiction and fact, right? Fantasy and reality. And I think so scripture, and you see that later in this case, right? You see Chad Daybell's writings initially are called fiction, and then they're taken to be reality later. And so I think Lori really is kind of on the edge of this fantastical world that she wants to make real, and Twilight and, you know, Hollywood movies, you know, a lot of this stuff starts factoring into the equation, which, by the way, is very common with the criminal mind in general. Like a lot of times with criminals and murderers, there's this struggle to kind of distinguish reality from fantasy. And I think you see that with Lori as well.
With a doomsday fascination, is that a way that a human being can cope with something like abuse? Is that like compartmentalizing, taking yourself to another place where all things that have affected you are immaterial because you're living in a fantasy world?
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. I agree. It's certainly, in this particular case, it was certainly something that Chad Daybell used to manipulate her, I think, by selling her on the fact that she was a goddess who was going to essentially join him at the table. He would be the king and she would be the queen, and they would run the New Jerusalem, right? So that had a huge amount of appeal to her. That was exactly the sort of thing she wanted to hear from Chad Daybell. And so, yes, I think post-apocalyptic or apocalyptic visions are largely an escape from reality, and they're, in many ways, and this, I go back to this time and time again with criminality, is they're sort of an avoidance of being human, right? Like at heart, I think in many ways, this case is about accepting our limitations as human beings and knowing where our limits are and understanding that, you know, developing some reasonable understanding of ourselves and some awareness of what we can do and what we can't do and what's real and what's not. And I think when we start exceeding those, we can get into problems.
So she meets Chad, and I was wondering if this was a love for him or the love of a religious figure. And you brilliantly said that it was like a love panacea, like her love for him will solve all of her problems. Does she love him as a religious figure or as husband number five?
I definitely think she loves him more as a fantasy. Mm. I think these two didn't really know each other well enough to understand that love is not some fantastic concoction, or, you know, they were both looking for some way out of their current situations and the boredom they were experiencing. And, you know, I think for Lori, part of this was drama. It was creating some drama and feeling special and, you know, kind of getting Chad to play along with this fantasy she had of being the goddess in the New Jerusalem. You know, I didn't talk about it in the documentary, but I keep going back to Macbeth a lot. From, you know, Macbeth is sort of my endless well for the criminal mind, because there's no particular interpretation that's accurate. And, you know, Macbeth and his wife, Lady Macbeth, they have this really unique relationship. And I think you see some elements of that with Chad and Lori. You know, Lady Macbeth says early on that he's soaked in the warmth of human kindness, and then he ends up being this butcher, right? And but she convinces him that he needs to murder the king. So you have this guy who's a warrior and he's used to killing people, but he's fundamentally kind, perhaps. And then Lady Macbeth convinces him. She basically tells him, you know what, you need to man up and kill the king, because we need to take control of the throne and we need to have power. And I think you have some dynamic like that with Lori and Chad, in the sense that I think Chad would have been perfectly content to sit back and, you know, create these fantasies and have people flock to him. But I think Lori wanted some action. So I think I could see Lori easily saying to Chad, you keep making these promises, you need to man up and do something and, you know, show me that this is serious, right? And so I think you have some version of that here. So I think Lori was much more inclined to action and drama, and she tends to be a little histrionic. And Chad's a little more docile. And perhaps, I don't know if I would say that, you know, he exhibits a lot of human kindness, but because he's very flat, he doesn't have a lot of emotion. But mm-hmm. But I think ultimately what set this whole thing in motion was the combination, right? It wasn't, does Macbeth kill the king if Lady Macbeth doesn't urge him to do so? I don't know. Probably not. You know, he hesitates a few times, but Lady Macbeth convinces him. And I think you probably have some version of that here with Lori and Chad. I think Chad's the mastermind, but Lori's sort of pulling the strings and goading him to move forward.
So it looks like through communication that he designates the system where he gives someone a number. Mm-hmm. And that number is basically indicates how much of a zombie has taken over a human being.
Yeah, there's a, right. You're either dark or light. And then, you know, I forget the cutoff now. I think it's like anything over 4.5 or 5 is considered dark. And then if you're like a 6, then you're irredeemable. You have to be. There has to be some type of exorcism or maybe even a murder to get the demon out, or the zombie out, as he would call it.
So you see text messages between Lori and her brother, Alex, where she's updating him on certain people's designations, like bad news, our brother is this, bad news, mm-hmm. someone is this.
Right.
So with this case, it's so confusing because as much as we have text messages, there's mm-hmm. still so much that's unknown. I feel like you're so deep into the woods in this case with research and speaking to people. Who do you think is the person that may have come up with the idea for the murder of the children and the person that pushed forward on it?
Yeah, that's such a tough question. You know, that's a question that I always say to people. You know, if that issue comes up in trial, I think we'll learn more. If it doesn't, it's maybe a mystery forever. But I think for me, you have to go back to, this is Chad's vision. This is Chad's system. This is his extremism. This is, you know, Lori might be helping co-create some of it, but Chad, for the most part, is really the one who develops the larger post-apocalyptic vision. And it's his writings, it's his books, which I've read. his fantasy world that he's created. And so in that sense, he starts the ball rolling. But again, like getting back to kind of the Macbeth analogy, Lady Macbeth really is the one who goads Macbeth on to take action. And I could see that happening here in terms of like who wished to murder the children. It's such a tough one. I clearly they both signed off on it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think again, if you go back to this to the numbering system that you just talked about with Chad, the system of dark and light, when Chad designates the children as dark, I think he set that ball in motion. So yeah. I think at that point, and he does that, by the way. So and he does everybody who ends up dead, including his wife Tammy, who was initially light and not a high dark number, she becomes dark at some point when it becomes convenient for him to get rid of her and develop a rationale for it. So, and I think Chad, as far as we can tell, Chad was the one making all of those designations. So in that sense, Chad sets the tone. And then, you know, after that, there's probably some persuasion. He's talking to Lori about it. He's trying to convince her. He needs her to sign off on it.
But at that point, she almost seems as if she's certainly without fear. She seems joyful and angry. But other than that, those are her only two real emotions. In your podcast, you do this great job of comparing Lori to Muhammad Atta, who was a 9/11 terrorist, and explaining how they both have a similar mindset when it comes to extreme radical religious beliefs. So like Lori, Atta had this fearless journey towards Allah. So those that were murdered on 9/11 were sort of immaterial because it's getting him to an eternal space where he believes he will be celebrated.
Yes.
And so for Lori, if her children die or if her brother dies or if anyone else dies, it doesn't matter because she believes that she's going to be celebrated by the Heavenly Father.
Yeah. So with Atta, one of the most fascinating things about Atta is that he left behind a note that they found in his car. I don't know if he intended it for to be discovered, but it was. And his note talks about basically how he's doing. Yes, he's doing it for Allah, but it really talks about how he's doing it for love. And and that's such a peculiar way to see it. He doesn't mention that he's about to kill thousands of human beings. He doesn't mention the destruction that's going to occur. He doesn't mention any of the particulars, really. He just talks about doing it for love. And so I think you kind of see, when you look at Atta, you kind of see his real motivation, which is he's got this distorted perception that he can drive a plane into the World Trade Centers and kill thousands of human beings. And somehow that's a loving act.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you've got a parallel with Lori in the sense that that's essentially why she's doing this. Not just her love of Daybell, but her love of scripture and this vision that Daybell's created. And the irony, of course, is similar in terms of, I think she sees murdering these people as a loving act. So you've got this enormous distortion of reality or of how most of us would perceive love, or at least right with her, it would be Christian love.
Mm.
They're both willing to murder and go to an extreme length to develop or envelope themselves in some sense of love.
So that makes sense why she doesn't react when people keep asking her in the months after they're missing, where are the children? Because in her mind, well, they're happy. They've moved on, and I'm going to be there at one point too. So why does anybody care?
Right, exactly. It's a really chilling way to see those statements now. That again, like Atta, you know, Atta sees himself in a place of love now, and surrounded by love, right? And Allah, and Lori probably has the same belief in terms of where the children went. And I mean, although it is in their system of thought, in their worldview, being labeled dark might exclude you from love to some degree, or it might exclude you from that post-apocalyptic world. So, So there is that. But I mean, these are not people that are worried about the consistency of their ideology.
So the people that were participating in Prepared for a People, how many people at the apex were participating in this group?
Yeah, that's a really tough question to answer, because even now, we just in the last week, we received a handful of emails from people saying, hey, you know, I know so-and-so, or I know these people that were involved in this and it followed Chad, but they would never go public with it. So there's you. I think you have this whole, you know, I don't know what the numbers would be, thousands.
Wow.
You have this whole movement or group of people that were kind of subversive and believe this stuff, but I don't know if it was because they were ashamed of those beliefs. I doubt that, but they were hiding a lot of these ideas or these beliefs, and but they believed in it. They followed Chad, and you know, I sometimes say that if Chad was a little more charismatic, this would have been a really interesting phenomenon. I think a lot more harm would have been done to people.
Do you think that there are current or former members of Prepared for People that are communicating with him still, even though he is in prison?
Yeah, that's a good... I don't know. We haven't learned that there's a lot of communication with members of the groups, but I think many of them... That's a really interesting question. I think many of them have tried to at least publicly distance themselves from him. But the reality, I don't, you know, I would imagine there's probably a few people, but I do think a lot of people have detached from Chad Daybell to some degree that were heavily involved in his group.
Was Tammy a member, and were his children members?
It appears that his children, or at least some of his children, were definitely true believers. Tammy seems to have endorsed it, but maybe not wholeheartedly.
And then on Lori's side, we know that Alex was a member, and Melanie, yeah, her niece, was a member. Anyone else?
Yeah, it doesn't, right. I think it was those two primarily.
And then according to her mental status exam in December of 2021, minimal insight into the severity of her condition, seriousness of potential consequences of the charges against her, judgment poor to fair, refuses recommended medications, remains loyal to problematic husband. They say that she's incompetent. Do you believe that was due to some type of schizophrenia? And if so, are there restorative treatments for competency?
It appears that there was a diagnosis of schizoaffective disorder, but you know, I would love to see the psychological evaluation, but obviously that's really privileged material. So I'm sure that won't be available until much later after this case closes. But schizoaffective is a form of schizophrenia. It's schizophrenia essentially with a mood disorder. So a mood disorder here would be depression, I would imagine, severe depression maybe. So yes, that would be amenable to some type of antidepressants, maybe some types of antipsychotics, depending on how bad the person believed it to be. So yeah, and restorative, to use your term, you know, the restorative approach through medication tends to be very effective. And so it seems to have worked here. She seems to have been restored to competence, and medication seems to be having some impact.
But can you also explain the difference between insane and incompetent? Because I think people are going to be monitoring this case, and I think that they get very frustrated.
Yeah.
Because one would assume she's insane. I mean, she had her children killed. So what is the difference between insane and incompetent?
So a determination of insanity would be the mental state at the time of the crimes.
Okay.
And it's always very difficult to determine that, right? So you would have to go back. And so I can do some testing with an inmate, for example, but most of the testing I'm going to do is going to give me the current state of mind. I'm going to have to make a lot of inferences and, inductive, inferences about state of the mind at the time of the crime. So if somebody has a personality disorder, for example, I would make the inference that they probably had that at the time of the crime. If somebody, I was recently involved in a murder case, where there was some question about, he claimed that he had PTSD. And there was some question about whether he was malingering and making that up. And, you know, I learned that he experienced some traumas as a child. Mm. So it's very unlikely that, you know, he would be malingering if he had PTSD as a child, right? You'd have to, you kind of have to look at the continuity of their mental health problems over time and whether there's a strong likelihood that at the time of the crime, the mental state was influenced by whatever those mental health issues were or continue to be. Competency, on the other hand, is current mental state. So competency would be evaluating the mental health or mental state of someone sitting before me in the here and now, in determining whether they're able to understand, you know, the charges against them and to participate in their defense and that kind of stuff. So, you know, if somebody's deemed incompetent, then the determination is that they cannot really understand what's going on and they can't participate in their defense in a way that would assist them. And so they're very different in the sense that one is a present focus and the other is focused on the past.
In May, new documents revealed that her mental health is extremely complex and fragile, or I should say, according to her attorneys. And they believe that she's the potential to be hospitalized again in the near future. There are people that have said she dances in her prison cell to imaginary music. Right. She's writing letters to Chad. How much do you believe, with all of your experience and your just gut and your intuition, how much of this is real and how much of this is an act to avoid having to answer some very difficult questions?
Right. Right. That's a really good question. I don't think there's a definitive answer to it. I think that my best response to that is that I talked to Colby several times, or actually Colby called me after learning of her designation of being incompetent. And he said, this is bull. This is not accurate. My mother has never been schizophrenic.
Wow.
She's never had serious mental health problems. I don't believe this. So, you know, a big part of my job is to interact with what we call collateral sources, which are, you know, family members, people that know the person, right? My job, oftentimes, it's more important in my job to talk to people surrounding that person than the actual person, because many, many felons, as you can imagine, you know, when I go in there fairly quickly after a crime, they're going to be in denial, or they're going to minimize what happened, right? Or they're going to deny it completely. And so the best way for me to ascertain some accurate version of what's going on is to talk to people that know the person and get their perceptions. And so I think it's pretty compelling when you have the son who's very close to her, maybe one of the closest people to her throughout time, over time, saying, I think this is a manipulation. My mom is always manipulating people. She's done it again. She's fooled the psychologist. She's fooled the judge. She's fooled the courts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she is not schizophrenic. So there's that element. But, you know, on the other side of that, you know, I do trust professional opinions and my colleagues. And so I have to believe that, you know, they're not grasping at straws, that they're basing that on something fairly compelling. But, you know, it's difficult. It's difficult. You know, in the case of Elizabeth Smart, for example, the offender in that case, he was deemed incompetent for years. And they finally brought in, the prosecution finally brought in an expert who they allowed him to have unlimited hours with the defendant. And he spent like 250 hours evaluating the case and really got to the bottom of it and found that the guy was totally malingering. So so maybe, you know, 20 hours isn't enough to really figure out Lori. Maybe you need over 100. I don't know. But I think a lot of it is sitting in a jail cell with her and interacting with her and kind of getting to know her and fully know her and to understand her mental health based upon those interactions, in addition to testing and talking to collaterals. And it's a tricky question. I don't, unless I could get in a jail cell with her and really spend some time with her and do some testing. And when I say time, I mean, the way I would address that issue with her is I would want to split up my interviews with her, because it would give me, you know, different slices of time and different perspectives, and to see if she's consistently acting in the same way. So I might go in with her, you know, maybe 8 hours once a week over a period of a month or something like that, just to really get a feel for what's going on. And I'm not sure that was done. So, but again, I would have to trust my colleagues and believe that their determination was reasonably accurate. So, but certainly the Colby observation is pertinent, and it's pretty compelling. And so if somebody has no history of schizophrenia and then in midlife, in their mid to late 40s, all of a sudden they're diagnosed, that's really unusual. So when I first learned about that, you know, most schizophrenia is diagnosed between the ages of like 18 and 26.
Right.
And so, you know, to have a late term diagnosis of schizophrenia, the odds are against it. You know, the probability of that is very, very low. And so, you know, another part of my job is to look at base rates. And, I don't know what the numbers are, maybe 1 in 1,000,000. I mean, they're very, very low, because schizophrenia is usually something that you can see and diagnose much earlier in life.
Well, I have to say, your podcast with your wife is excellent. I recommend it for everyone to listen to. You do tremendous work. Where can they listen to your show?
So we're found, our podcast itself, which is Hidden True Crime, we're on all the major platforms, Spotify, Apple, Google. So we can be found anywhere. If you just go to any podcast platform and type in Hidden True Crime. We started a Patreon account too, because there were many things we wanted to talk about that I felt were kind of better discussed in a private forum. So, so we do, you know, for example, we just recently talked about Colby was just arrested.
Yeah.
Recently, which was really sad. And I didn't really feel at the moment, I didn't feel comfortable talking about that publicly. So we talked about it on Patreon. So we're on Patreon.
I want to thank Sky and Dr. John Mathias and remind you to click subscribe and leave a 5-star review. Please join the Facebook group Reality Life with Kate Casey to talk about this episode. I really would love to know your thoughts on this case. So again, that group is called Reality Life with Kate Casey. Just put it in the search button of Facebook. You can also follow me on Twitter. I would love to hear what you think of this case. You can find me at Kate Casey on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram at Kate Casey CA. You can find me on TikTok at It's Kate Casey. You can find me on Cameo. Patreon for bonus episodes by going to Patreon, patreon.com/KateCasey. And as mentioned, make sure that you get tickets to my live shows November 20th in New York City at the City Winery and on December 3rd at the Hollywood Improv in Los Angeles. I'm hoping that you have a great week. And I look forward to circling back with you next week when I talk to Shayna from Love is Blind 2.
Listen to the 48 Hours podcast for shocking murder cases and compelling real-life dramas from one of television's most watched true crime shows. Go behind the scenes of each episode with award-winning CBS News correspondents and producers in Postmortem, a weekly deep dive. Listen to 48 Hours wherever you get your podcasts.